The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Long before millennials were bemoaned as the most self-absorbed, ungrateful generation in existence, young people in the 1970s were labeled as the Me Generation by their elders. The phrase was coined by a couple writers commenting on what they saw as a rise of narcissism in young people. After the radical and revolutionary 1960s, the 1970s brought forward self-realization and self-fulfillment. New Age spirituality, health and exercise fads, self-help programs and books, lifestyle products, discos and nightclubbing became all the rage. And it was a new era of liberation for women. So much so that in 1975, Time awarded its Man of the Year to American women, saying, quote, "They have arrived like a new immigrant wave in male America. They may be cops, judges, military officers, telephone linemen, cab drivers, pipe fitters, editors, business executives, or mothers and housewives, but not quite the same subordinate creatures they were before. Across the broad range of American life, from suburban tract houses to state legislatures, from church pulpits to army barracks, women's lives are profoundly changing, and with them, the traditional relationships between the sexes." End quote. While the 1970s were a time of independence and fulfillment, they were also a time when many, especially women, lived in fear. In California, the Zodiac Killer began his murder spree with the shootings of high school students Betty Lou Jensen and David Faraday in December of 1968. He would go on to claim 37 murders in a letter to the press, one of many, postmarked in 1974. In Chicago, John Wayne Gacy, the killer clown, raped and murdered at least 33 teenage boys and young men between 1972 and 1978. In Tallahassee, Florida, Ted Bundy snuck into the Chio Mega House in January of 1978 and sexually assaulted and attacked the women who lived there, including bludgeoning and strangling Margaret Bowman and Lisa Levy to death. The day before his execution, Bundy confessed to 30 murders, all young women, all committed throughout the 1970s. As we discussed in last week's episode, in Dallas, over a short time span from 1970 to 1971, a slew of murders occurred, which the press dubbed the Bizarre Lust Murders. The killings were all young to middle-aged women, and most were considered to be sexually motivated due to the graphic nature of the crimes, though sexual assault or rape didn't always occur. There were other similarities as well. There were physical resemblances. In more than one case, the face had been wiped clean. Many were stabbed multiple times. Some were described as being mutilated. Many were found nude or partially undressed. The obvious conclusion that one killer murdered all of the women becomes puzzling when considering that three of the murders have been marked as solved by police and by different killers. Still, most remain unsolved despite no shortage of suspects. The prosecutor who worked on many of the murders spoke to the media about the cases in 1971, saying, quote, "The unsolved killings may or may not be related. The similarities may mean nothing. To be brutally frank, there is just so much one of these people can do to a human body." Thank you. Built in the late 1960s, Willow Creek was a sprawling 42-acre complex in North Dallas with 1,200 multifamily apartment units just 15 miles from the heart of downtown Dallas. The goal of the complex was to create a private oasis that made residents feel as if they were in a country setting rather than an urban atmosphere. The architects aimed for prestige, a different feel than the typical institutional appearance of most apartment complexes of the day, so they used irregular roof and wall lines, plus recessed balconies with high slatted wood railings. They added details like streams, lakes, waterfalls, most artificially created from land that was previously as flat as a table. Willow Creek also boasted a 17,000-square-foot country club with a 4,000-square-foot restaurant on its site, with the club being only available to residents of the Willow Creek community and including everything from sauna baths to card rooms. It was at this country club that Carolyn Montgomery, a 28-year-old single mother, worked as a waitress to support herself and her son in the fall of 1971. Carolyn had only been working at the country club for about 3 weeks, but she was already well-liked by her co-workers. She had confided in them about her struggles to raise her 6-year-old son, DeQuinn, on her own. She was a loving mother. She was kind, and she was short, less than 5 feet tall, and pretty, with perfectly coiffed brunette hair. In addition to 6-year-old DeQuinn, Carolyn had a 9-year-old boy from an earlier marriage who lived away from her in Port Arthur, Carolyn's hometown. Carolyn wasn't really a party girl, but she would join fellow employees at after-hours spots in the North Dallas area every now and then. However, on Saturday, August 7th, 1971, Carolyn went straight home after work. She was working the late-night shift, so she didn't leave the club until about 1:30 a.m., Sunday the 8th. Carolyn didn't live in the prestigious Willow Creek apartments. She lived about a half an hour away with her son and a roommate in the Sherwood Forest apartment building near Dallas's Love Field Airport. The apartments were on a sprawling complex just off the Northwest Highway and had a half-timbered, castled look. Carolyn had been living there for just about 7 months. She was seen by neighbors entering the 2-bedroom, 2-bath apartment unit at about 2 a.m. Carolyn's roommate, who was also 28 and a cocktail waitress at the same club, was not at home that night, as she had gone to visit her parents in Marshall over the weekend. So, 6-year-old DeQuinn had been home alone since the time his mother left for work, but he was used to it by now. He was often home by himself while his mother went to work. There was no babysitter, although a neighbor sometimes checked in on him, and DeQuinn frequently stopped by the neighbor's apartment as well. The 6-year-old boy watched television alone, and then put himself to bed that night in a room at the back of the apartment that he shared with his mother. DeQuinn didn't wake when she returned to the apartment at 2 a.m., and he didn't wake when his mother was viciously attacked not long after. At 4:45 a.m., a heavy Sunday newspaper was delivered to the doorway of the apartment. By the time 6-year-old DeQuinn awoke at daylight, about 8:30 a.m., and dressed himself, the newspaper had been brought into the apartment. He went into the living room and saw his mother lying on her back, covered with a blanket near the front door. At 6 years old, he didn't understand that something was wrong. Decades later, DeQuinn would tell CBS DFW, quote, "There was a blanket and everything else. I thought she's sleeping on the floor, so I went out to play." DeQuinn went outside in search of a playmate, but couldn't find one, so he rode his bike around by himself. When he returned to the apartment around 10 a.m., his mother hadn't moved, so this time he went to check on her. He pulled the blanket back and discovered the deceased body of his mother. As an adult, thinking back on that moment, DeQuinn told CBS DFW, "You don't know what death is at 6 years old. It still haunts me." At such a young age, DeQuinn didn't fully understand the state his mother was in, but he still knew enough to run to a neighbor's apartment for help. The neighbor stated that DeQuinn rushed up to him and said, "Something's wrong with my mommy. She's lying on the floor and she's got blood on her." The neighbor did not believe DeQuinn, so instead of checking on it himself, he sent a 5-year-old girl into Carolyn's apartment to see what was going on. The girl returned and said that she saw a knife sticking out of Carolyn Montgomery's neck. Giving the neighbor the benefit of the doubt, I imagine he wasn't expecting this response, or he wouldn't have sent another small child. The police were finally called. Upon arrival, police discovered that Carolyn had been brutally stabbed to death. She was discovered near the front door on her back, arms outstretched, and one leg bent. Underneath the blanket, she was found semi-nude. Her clothing, including blue and white polka dot shorts, had been stripped off by the killer, some with a knife and some torn by hand. Most of the clothing was found scattered and shredded around her body, but the shorts were found largely intact underneath her body, indicating that they had been cut open with a knife from the front while she was in the same position she was found in. Carolyn had been stabbed repeatedly, at least 10 times. There were also numerous slashes across her mutilated body. Her chest and throat had been cut deeply, and the murder weapons were still embedded in her body. A 10 to 12 inch butcher knife was discovered lodged in her throat, and a smaller 4 inch paring knife was found in the abdomen area. It was a brutal and vicious attack. Teeth marks were discovered on the body, and one breast was nearly fully severed. Wounds discovered on Carolyn's arms revealed that she had fought back against her killer. The rest of the apartment showed no signs of a struggle, except for Carolyn's roommate's room, which had been ransacked, with drawers being pulled open and purses dumped out. There was no sign of forced entry. Despite the attack's brutal nature, it didn't result in enough noise to wake DeQuinn or disturb the neighbors. The Sunday newspaper that was delivered at 4:45 a.m. was found inside the apartment. In all likelihood, the killer spent time in the apartment after murdering Carolyn and then brought it in himself before leaving. This wouldn't be inconsistent because after stabbing and slashing Carolyn to death, the killer took the time to wipe her face and body clean of blood, lay a blanket over her butchered body, and to leave a note. Police discovered the note of an apology scratched into a piece of cardboard that the killer had taken from the backing of an 8x10 photograph. The note read, "The wrong one. I'm sorry." Handwriting analysis would be nearly impossible because the words were not written with pen or pencil. They were cut in using a sharp object. The killer going over each letter several times, likely to ensure they were visible on the dark cardboard backing. He used both capital and lowercase letters and scratched an underline about 3 times beneath the word "sorry." The note was left on a chair beside the body. Carolyn's case was handed over to the Dallas Murder Squad, and 3 detectives were assigned to the case full-time. One murder squad detective stated that, quote, It was one of the most grisly murders I've ever seen. He added that the apology note, which stated, "The wrong one, I'm sorry," could imply that the murderer killed the wrong person. Perhaps Carolyn's roommate was the intended target, as her room was ransacked. Or the note could have been left in an attempt to lead detectives off track. The murder squad seemed to feel that the latter was the case. Carolyn's son, DeQuinn, was interviewed at police headquarters, but because he slept through the entire attack, he could not give detectives any substantial clues. DeQuinn was then released to his father, Abrason Samuel Montgomery, who was a 28-year-old musician. While still legally married, Abrason and Carolyn had separated and may have been headed towards a divorce. Still, the couple remained friendly, and Abrason said they had talked about getting back together. He was quoted in a local newspaper as saying that Carolyn was, quote, "part of the now generation. You know, do what you want to do. We discussed it several times, and she started to come out of it. She found work in clubs with older members. During the last 6 months, her attitude had changed. She had started to come back to the conservative look. We talked not long ago about getting back together and trying to get our heads together. I think the child was really a bond between us. She really loved him. He knows. He's been asking questions. Why do people have to die? Will my mama be back?" Abrason stated that the last time he saw his wife was the Thursday before she was murdered. The murder squad investigated Abrason, and he was quickly ruled out, as his activities the night of the murder were fully accounted for. An autopsy was conducted by the Dallas County Medical Examiner, and it revealed that Carolyn had been dead about 8 hours when her body was discovered, putting her time of death not long after she arrived home to her apartment at 2 a.m. Investigators were not able to determine whether her killer was hiding in the apartment, waiting for Carolyn to return, whether he forced his way in, or if she let him in willingly once she arrived. Investigators were also not able to determine a motive for the slaying. In fact, they were quite baffled. A local newspaper at the time reported, quote, "Police have found it difficult to follow the workings of a mind capable of directing such a crime." Throughout their investigation, the murder squad considered all possibilities, including that either Carolyn or her roommate was the intended target, or even a neighbor or fellow worker. They spoke to several of Carolyn's friends and co-workers, to casual acquaintances and neighbors, but none could provide investigators with any leads or clues as to the identity of the killer. The murder squad also questioned Carolyn's roommate. She was unable to identify whether the knives found still embedded in Carolyn's body came from the apartment, but a later news article reported that they did. Investigators then learned of an incident that occurred at the apartment just the day before Carolyn was killed. Early Saturday morning, a 20-year-old woman saw a man's car parked outside the apartment and went into a jealous rage. The man in question was a 28-year-old bartender from Garland, and while news articles don't make it clear, presumably this man was her boyfriend and she had just discovered his car at another woman's apartment. The bartender was visiting Carolyn's roommate when the woman kicked in the apartment door and threatened everyone in the apartment, the bartender, the roommate, and Carolyn. As she left the apartment, the jealous woman jerked on the door and broke the night latch, although the main door lock remained intact. Police later received a destruction of private property complaint concerning the incident. And once Carolyn was discovered murdered the following day, Detectives questioned both the bartender and the jealous woman, but concluded that the disturbance did not appear to be related to the killing. Investigators also looked into an abduction and rape that occurred a few days after Carolyn's murder, and just 3 blocks away. On that day, a 49-year-old woman stepped outside of a bowling alley to get some fresh air when a man came up from behind and stuck a gun in her side. The man then forced the woman into her own car and drove to an unknown street somewhere in South Dallas. He rifled through her purse, then forced the woman to disrobe and raped her. The man eventually had the woman lie down and warned her not to get up until he was gone. He took off, and after waiting a while, the woman went to a phone and called police. Due to the timing and proximity of the assault, investigators looked into the possibility that the same perpetrator committed that rape and killed Carolyn Montgomery. But while the rape was a horrible, vicious act, detectives deduced that it was not the same level of brutality that Carolyn faced, and they were ultimately unable to make a connection. Overall, there seemed to be very few leads for police to go on. 3 days after Carolyn's murder, Police Chief Frank Dyson held a press conference describing the brutal murder as very disturbing and stating, quote, "I hope that we can develop leads on this case." But news articles from the time reported that police had been unable to find any tangible clues that would lead to the identity of the killer. Investigators looked at over a dozen suspects, analyzed fingerprints, blood, and both murder weapons. But the forensic technology we know today was not available to them. Almost as quickly as her body was found, the case seemed to go cold. About 9 months after Carolyn's murder, another woman was found dead in a similar manner that had investigators wondering about a connection. Miss Linda Nunziata's body was found Saturday, May 6, 1972, in her apartment in Arlington near the University of Texas campus there. Both Carolyn and Linda were slashed and stabbed to death. Both women had been waitresses who worked night shifts. Both killers used a butcher knife on their victim, and both bodies were wiped clean of blood. The similarities were striking. A few years later, in early 1974, a man under questioning on the charges of murdering a woman in Fort Worth, also with a butcher knife, confessed to killing Linda Nunziata and another woman from Illinois. The suspect, Michael Foster Vines, a 21-year-old musician, admitted that he murdered the 3 women during drug-induced fantasies while high on speed and other drugs. Due to the similarities, officers also questioned him about Carolyn Montgomery's murder, but they were ultimately unable to connect Vines to Carolyn's slaying. Vines did state that he distinctly remembers setting up 25 women for murder, that he picked them out to die and made plans to kill them. But he claimed that his memory becomes hazy after that, and beyond the 3 he was already charged with, he couldn't say how many women he actually killed or where any other murders might have taken place. Vines would go on to plead guilty to 2 of the murders and receive 2 life sentences. Back in 1971, the local media added Carolyn Montgomery's name to the ever-growing list of unsolved murders of young to middle-aged women that had taken place in Dallas and the surrounding area in the past 2 years. Detectives generally declined to blame the killings on one murderer. There are similarities in all of them, but we have nothing conclusive that would lead us to blame them on one man, a detective told the local news. But the media and the community couldn't help but wonder if the cases were all connected, if the killings could be the work of one sadistic, homicidal psychopath. One article from The Time even went so far as to speculate that the killer was a maniac who really wanted to kill his wife or mother, but settled instead for killing female strangers. Eventually, even investigators were forced to admit that there may be a connection. As we discussed on last week's episode, on August 17, 1971, Dallas police held a conference with around 12 local law enforcement agencies to compare notes about the slew of unsolved homicides. Information about the bizarre lust murders of several Dallas area women were fed into a computer to determine if there was a common link that would lead police to the killer or killers. Sheriff's deputies stated that it would be the first time that a computer had ever been employed to attempt to solve a series of murders. County Sheriff Clarence Jones added that police authorities in Massachusetts had considered using a computer in their search for the Boston Strangler several years ago, but apparently did not. At the Dallas conference, officers from the local area were provided with a questionnaire to be filled out for each unsolved homicide. The questionnaire included blanks ranging from physical traits all the way to victims' zodiac signs. Once filled out and collected, the questionnaires were to be run through the computer to look for common denominators. While the details of the computer's findings were not made public, it was stated that at least six of the Dallas area murders were found to be very similar in circumstance. Unfortunately, the results did little to guide investigators in finding the killer or killers, as most of the murders remain unsolved to this day. We have discussed the following 9 slayings in the last 3 City of Hate episodes of Gone Cold, of which the similarities are striking, but this is not an all-inclusive list. January 6, 1970, 19-year-old Jeanette Starnes Smith in Irving, first knocked unconscious by a blow to the jaw, strangled, and stabbed 9 times in the chest and abdomen with a butcher knife, which was left protruding from her chest, unsolved. February 18, 1970, 21-year-old Patricia Ann Mahaney in Oak Cliff, punched just under the left eye, strangled until she lost consciousness, stabbed over 40 times with 2 different knives, and her throat slashed. Solved. March 27, 1970, 49-year-old Earl Cancellor Crossland, nicknamed Tiny Richardson, stabbed over 40 times with 2 different knives and her throat slashed. Solved, although many law enforcement officers felt they got the wrong guy. August 9, 1970, 26-year-old Linda Jane Phillips in Oak Lawn stabbed 26 times and her throat slashed, reportedly solved when Henry Lee Lucas confessed to the crime. September 8, 1970, 19-year-old Deborah Diane Palmer, North Dallas, missing, unsolved. October 28, 1970, 36-year-old Beverly Jean Hope, struck by a stick of firewood nearly 30 times, bludgeoned mostly in the head, unsolved. Saturday, January 2, 1971, 19-year-old Myrtle Ann Etheridge, Plano, stabbed 4 times, 3 times in the chest, and once in the stomach, unsolved. February 8, 1971, 22-year-old Barbara Joan Mormon, Irving, badly beaten in the left side of the head and right side of her chest, strangled and her throat slashed, unsolved. August 8, 1971, 28-year-old Carolyn Montgomery, Love Field, stabbed at least 10 times, slashed and mutilated with a butcher knife, and a smaller paring knife, which were both left embedded in her body, unsolved. 7 of the 9 women were not believed to be sexually assaulted, but 6 of the 9 were found nude or partially nude. In February 2012, Carolyn Montgomery's son, DeQuinn, spoke to CBS DFW about the then 41-year-old unsolved murder of his mother. In the interview, he looked back fondly on the brief memories he does have of his mother, the way her face lit up after he finished a drawing, the way she helped him color, or welcomed him back from playing outside. He said, quote, "It's the little things, like someone that actually believes in you as you're doing things, but now it's as if all I remember is what happened to her." Much of the evidence in his mother's murder has unfortunately since been contaminated, making it nearly impossible for the Dallas Police Department to now conduct any forensic testing, but DeQuinn still hopes for closure, for the case to be solved. He told CBS DFW, "She lived until she was 28. That's it. So whoever is out there that did this, they had a full life. What did she do to deserve this? Sounds like a monster." If you have any information about the murder of Carolyn Montgomery, please contact the Dallas Police Department Cold Case Squad at 214-671-3661. If you are going to be at CrimeCon in New Orleans, you may just catch us at one of the meetups or stop by the Southern Fried True Crime booth on Podcaster Row, where Gone Cold's Erica will be hanging out with our friend, Southern Fried True Crime's Erica. Just a reminder, you may find the episodes The Slayer Saint and The Odessa Lust Murders available exclusively on patreon.com/gonecoldpodcast, particularly pertinent to the subject of this and our last two episodes. And we'd sincerely like to thank our donors, both new and those of you who have been around a while, for your support of the show. It helps immensely. The Dallas Morning News, the Odessa American, the Austin American Statesman, the Grand Prairie Daily News, and D Magazine were used as sources for this episode. And if you're interested in all things true crime, we've got a couple of blog recommendations for you. Check out cowtowncrime.com for an amazing and thorough look at cases in the Dallas-Fort Worth and North Texas area. Podcast reviews, too. Also, at thetruecrimefiles.com, you'll find a ton of true crime cases from just about anywhere, many unknown or ignored by the media, as well as book reviews, podcast reviews, and guest posts. Both thetruecrimefiles.com and cowtowncrime.com are our favorite spots on the web for learning about cases we might not have heard of otherwise. Check them both out. Thanks for listening, y'all.